On Sunday, August 19th at 11 p.m., Sugar in My Bowl presents multidimensional bassist and composer Jamaluddin Tukuma. Join us as we discuss parts of Jamaluddin Tukuma's career and discuss what's happening in the red carpet room. That's Sunday, August 19th at 11 p.m., right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org on the web. Listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Sugar in My Bowl is the name of this program. My name's Joyce Jones. And our guest for this evening is bassist, composer, and band leader, Jamaluddin Tukuma. However, we're going to start off the program, as most people are doing, paying tribute to someone we lost this past Thursday, the Queen, Aretha Franklin. We're going to open up the program with the title selection from Hey Now, Hey, The Other Side of the Sky, from her 1973 release on Atlantic Records. Stay tuned. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Sugar in My Bowl, starting now.
I can fix things up so they'll go. What's the matter, Daddy? Come on, save my soul. I want some sugar in my bowl. I ain't fooling. I want some sugar.
Thank you. Joyce Jones, and I'm on the line with
Jamaluddin Takuma.
Jamaluddin Takuma, thank you so much for joining Sugar in My Bowl. I am grateful that you're able to chat.
I am as well, and thanks for reaching out to me.
I want to clarify something.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this isn't something that you do. This seems to be what other people do. They say that you're a Philadelphia native, but I have you being born in Hempstead, New York.
Yeah, well, that happened. Well, I was born in Hempstead, New York, but my parents moved to Philadelphia after 1 month.
Oh!
So I have been here in Philadelphia from 1 month on to 62.
Okay. Well, that explains that. Do you know why they chose Philadelphia?
Well, my parents came up to Philadelphia from North Carolina. It was part of that migration. The folks were coming up to the North trying to make better for themselves. And they moved to New York because my father's aunt lived there. So she kind of took them in, and then after that, they got their own place here in Philadelphia. So that's where we wind up here in Philly.
Okay.
God damn, you think you could survive amongst this hostile tribe and not be smart, plus tough, with all that heart? Those who dug Lester Young would understand. What's happening, Prez? Understand. What's happening, friends? What's happening, Prez? You're the president.
Mm-hmm. how did you come upon playing the bass? Was that your first instrument?
It's interesting. Yes, that was my first and only instrument, actually. There's a theater here in Philadelphia called the Uptown Theater, which is comparable to, like, the Apollo Theater in New York, the Howard in Washington, and all of the various theaters that sort of hosted the Chitlin Circuit, as they called it back in the day.
Right.
Whereas R&B and soul groups used to frequent those theaters, having to play there with their hit commercial radio records that they had at the time. So at the Uptown Theater here in Philadelphia, which was around the corner from me on Broad Street, I was able to see all of the groups that were happening at the time in the 60s and 70s. You know, the Temptations, Philly groups like the Stylistics, the Intruders, the Delphonics.
Wow.
You know, the Tramps, and all of these groups that played here in Philadelphia, they would play there as well as some of the groups out of Jersey with Sylvia Robinson, who had a record called Stang Records. One of the groups was called The Moment. They did a very famous song called Love on a Two-Way Street.
Yes.
And the band that played behind The Moments and the Whatnots and all of those groups was a band from Jersey called Willie and the Mighty Magnificent. And so I would go to the Uptown and I would see them, and I would see bass players that play with all these groups play. And before playing the bass, I was a singer like that, with a group within a group that we used to doo-wop and we used to step and all that kind of stuff. But I was always fascinated by the bass player from the audience. So I remember going down south, North Carolina, one of the years of the vacation period in junior high school, and my mother used to send me down there to basically escape the gang warfare that was happening in Philadelphia. My aunt had a tobacco farm, so there I was sort of trained and learned discipline, waking up at 5 o'clock in the morning, going to the farm, helping them out, and all that kind of stuff, and it was cool. But now, in their house, I remember there was a guitar sitting in the corner, and that guitar, which is normally has 6 strings, only had 4 strings on it, and I know that the guitar wasn't in tune because I didn't know how to tune it. It was just there. But what I do remember is that picking that guitar up with the 4 strings and 2 of the strings missing, playing one of the Temptation songs called Get Ready, which was easy to learn on 1 string.
Oh, wow.
So it was like, do, 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 do. I figured out how to do that on 1 string. I was like, wow, this is pretty easy. But that was the only thing that I ever learned how to play. But when I came back home to Philadelphia, I expressed to my mother that I wanted to play guitar, bass, or whatever. We were walking down Erie Avenue, it was called here in Philadelphia, and there was a pawn shop. I remember looking up at the pawn shop, and my mother, she looked at me, and I said, wow, I would like to have that instrument. And it was a white Japanese bass made by this company called Kimberly. It was a hollow body, and it looked almost like a B.B. King guitar. You know, the red guitar that B.B. King uses, the Gibson. Only on B.B. King's guitar where it has the white piping around it. This had black piping. So I told my mother, I said, wow, I'd like to have that. So about 2 or 3 weeks later, I come home from school. Boom, a box is sitting on my bed. And I found out that my mother and my sister put together and got that for me. And so for 1 year, I just stayed in my room while all my other guys was hanging out, dating girls. I was just in my room practicing and learning how to play the bass. And after 1 week of having that bass, I got in a band. Yeah, I met this guitar player who had a band called the Soul Experience, which was pretty prevalent. There was a lot of soul bands happening in Philadelphia, the Soul Deviant, the Soul Phonics, the Soul Eruption, blah, blah, blah. And this band was called the Soul Experience. Playing for 1 week, I met this guy named Michael Broadnax, who was sort of a mentor to me, maybe 3 years older than I was at the time. And this was the only lie that I could ever remember telling. I don't remember telling lies, because it was one thing. I try to be the honest person, but there was just one lie that I told, and I'll never forget it. So I told him that I had, like, all this equipment. And, like, back then it was a thing, like, if you had equipment, wow, if you had, like, all these speakers and amplifiers, you can get in the band. So I told Michael, I said, listen, I got, like, all these amps, PA system speakers for the band can use. And if you let me in the band, we can hold my stuff. So
oh, my goodness.
They let me in the band. And that Friday night, don't you know, a gig came up, and it was like, okay, so we coming past the up the gear, and I said, oh, and I had to tell the truth.
Oh.
And we got through that gig, like, playing through, like, one amp. I think he played in the, you know, whatever he had. And that was that. But they let me in the band, and I have been in the band ever since. And for that whole period, I learned how to play. And then I started playing in the high school band. It was an interesting high school band that we had, because the high school was in an area where there was a heavy Hispanic community. So unlike other high school bands where there were marching bands and with horns and all this stuff, because of the Latin influence, we had the only Latin high school band, which was really cool, because there I learned the music of Eddie Palmieri, the music of Willie Colon, the music of Ray Barreto, on and on and on.
It's like,
and
all the folks who were on the Fania label.
Exactly. Bobby Valentin, blah, 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 blah. That happened, and then when I got out of high school, there was a band here in Philadelphia called Catalyst, which was comprised of Odine Pope on saxophone.
Oh, wow.
Sherman Ferguson on drums, Tyrone Brown became a teacher on bass, and Eddie Green on keyboards. And they had this band called Catalyst. They used to back up Pat Martino, the guitarist, and they used to also back up Billy Paul.
Oh, wow.
When they had that record out, Me and Mrs. Jones. So they used to do the backup for that. So they had started an organization called Model Cities. And Model Cities was an organization that sort of mentored music students and sort of kept them off the streets and provided an inspiring mentorship to them. So I was part of that. And so me being a part of that, they knew who I was. So when I got out of high school, I had a scholarship to go to Berklee College of Music. And I didn't want to go there because I wanted to be the musician that played on the road. And I didn't want that scholarship. I was suggested to go on the road with an organ player named Charles Erland.
Oh, yes.
And
The Mighty Burner.
So I was on the road with Charles Erland for about a year. Didn't go to Berklee. Was on the road with him for about a year. Played all around the country, helping him lift that heavy Hammond B3 organ up the steps.
Wow.
And all that stuff. And so after one gig at the, what was that, the club in Newark called the Key Club. Time for me to go back and get my money, get paid. And he says, I can't use you anymore.
Oh, no.
I was like, what? Are you serious? I didn't go to college.
Oh, no.
He says, yeah, I'm sorry. And I said, well, look, I said, okay, I can accept this. And I was like 19 years old or whatever. I said, I can accept this, but it's one thing I have to know. I have to know why. Because it's going to haunt me for the rest of my days.
Sure.
If I don't know why, you fire me. And he says, you know, because of your time. Because
what?
Your timing is off and this. I said, are you serious? The drummer and I was killing it every night. But what it was that here I was, this bass player. Now, mind you, these organ players at the time, this was a new thing. We're talking like in the 70s where there was a fusion of music, this fusion of rock and jazz.
Right.
And so the organ players were always used to playing the organ with their left hand or either their foot. So here comes this bass player that he wanted to use, and I'm coming in the band, and I'm coming in, and I always had a fashion sense, remember, because I used to be at the Uptown Theater. I used to see all of those groups play there. They used to be sharp as a tack. And then, of course, the guys in my neighborhood, we all used to like to dress, but that stuck with me. So here comes this young bass player coming in there with a white guitar strap with gold shoes.
Uh-oh.
And when he would take a solo, and I would take a solo, the crowd would go crazy. And I don't think Mr. Erland was really feeling that, you know.
So the attention was off of him.
Yeah, a little bit.
Yeah.
That's what, you know, that's what, to be honest, that's
oh
what it was.
Oh, my goodness.
You know, so that's what it was. But now, as creator would have it, so I'm coming home crying, my upright bass in one hand, because I used to take my upright with me just to practice it,
okay.
My electric bass in one case in another hand, and my suitcase, and I come home, and my mom says, okay, come on back home, honey. Come home. And exactly 1 week later, I get a call from percussionist James Toomey, who went on to become a producer with the group Ken Toomey. They had the
exactly.
song Juicy Fruit. And so Reggie Lucas was a guitar player
yes.
here in Philadelphia. They both were a production team. Later,
yes.
was, you know, doing productions with Stephanie Mills.
Yes.
And Reggie went on to become the first Madonna producer, blah, 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 blah. And they were doing production with Stephanie Mills. But at that time, they were both with Miles Davis.
Exactly.
They were in that group, the Miles Davis Selection Man. So he called me, Reggie and James called me and said, listen, there's this saxophone player in New York named Ornette Coleman. He wants to know, would you be interested in coming up to New York to rehearse with him? He's going to Europe for 2 weeks. And I was like, wow, I heard about Ornette, but I really wasn't clear about him. I remember reading something about him in the old Downbeat magazine in the library in school, and I really wasn't familiar with his music because, remember, I was coming through the R&B situation.
Right.
I was listening to, like, Return to Forever, you know, John McLaughlin. We were listening to that fusion kind of stuff. Of course, we were listening to Mandrill, the War, and
right.
Rufus, and Chicago, and all that stuff. And so I was like, okay. So I went to New York, and Ornette's music was very different, and we started the song off, and I was like, oh, I know I played it wrong, but he liked the way I played it, you know, so... You know, would you like to go to Europe with me?
Oh,
I was
wow.
like, sure. And we were supposed to go to Europe for 2 weeks, and we wound up staying there for 6 months.
Oh, my.
Yeah, so that's how it all started.
Oh, my goodness. So at that time when you were going to Europe with Ornette, how old were you?
Oh, I had to be like 19 to 20, yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, that was fun. And then I was with Ornette Valentine Band for like 12 years.
Yes.
And then my first album, Showstopper, he wrote a song for me called Takuma Song.
Right.
And, you know, he just saw how I was developing, and he wanted me to be on my own. And then I had did a sort of a recording contract with a label called Grammavision.
Yes.
Which was in New York. And they allowed me to do all the musical things that I wanted to do, and they didn't put any restrictions on me. And so that's how that happened. So ever since, I've been making my own records, producing, and producing others as well.
Now, I don't want to spend too much time talking about Ornette, because a lot of people do, but we have to talk about the time that you spent.
Right. It's okay.
What did you learn being with Ornette? What did you pick up?
Well, the freedom of your instrument, the freedom of being able to hear something other than what was happening at the time, and thinking of sound more than notes, because with notes, one could be very limited. With sound, you can create a whole different atmosphere of an audio experience. So with Ornette, it sort of opened my horizons, because remember, again, I was that R&B bass player, that funk bass player, that jazz bass player, and with Ornette, it just took the instrument. It allowed me to look at the instrument, my bass guitar, as being as equal as any other instrument that would be on the bandstand, because just in terms of a commercial idea, or the way that the instruments that has been promoted to the masses or the audience, you always think of the guitar player being out front. You always think of the saxophone being out front, or a vocalist for that matter being out front, or even a violin or whatever.
Right.
But you never really think of the bass guitar, because the bass guitar in commercial music has a particular arranged role. But with Ornette's music and the way that I learned how to improvise, it allowed me to think freely in terms of compositional improvising.
Also, in talking about expressing yourself as a bassist and being in that band in particular, or just in the future, what does the term harmelotics mean as far as playing the bass?
Well, with Ornette, harmonics was just a complete way of life, because it applied to things that happen organically, things that happen naturally, and a way of approaching something where you're free.
Okay.
And in a musical sense, harmonics with Ornette was basically when the harmony, and unlike in Western music where you have the harmony, the melody, all in this secure little comfortable place, in harmonics you have the harmony, the melody, and the rhythm moving in the same direction simultaneously.
Mm.
Thank you. good.
Is there more that you can add to that, or that's it in a nutshell?
Basically, that's it in a nutshell. Okay. In a nutshell, but of course, when you're thinking of music and you're actually sitting together with a band, all of those various aspects of harmonics could be worked out, you know, and it becomes discussion, and after discussion, it becomes execution. It's almost like when you think of people that don't know anything about Western music, they don't know anything about playing A to G or C to B, they don't know anything about that, but yet they're able to create music that's pretty incredible in terms of sound.
Did you ever go back to school?
Yeah, on the road, no.
Yeah.
Not
formal.
I mean, not really formally.
Yeah.
But I learned an awful lot just being with other musicians.
I am sure.
And also, I do master classes.
Mm-hmm.
And in my master class, one of the classes I call Harmonic Gems. That was the last one that I had been working on. But one of the first master classes that I had been working on, I titled it Music and the Human Experience. And I get a chance to elaborate on various things that some of these musicians who are very green, you know, they don't know about. And it's the kind of stuff that nobody will tell them. They will only find out once they're out there. So I try to give them a head start in knowing what to expect, letting them know that some of you guys are going to be great bass players and some of you not. And they go, wow, I didn't pay $100 to hear that. And I say, okay, well, let me slow it down now. This is going to be the deal. This road is moving in one direction, then all of a sudden it's going to twist and turn. And you guys are going to find yourselves in other areas of the music business. It's going to be satisfying, but it's not necessarily going to mean that you're going to be Jaco Pastorius or Stanley Clark or Jamala DiTacuma or whatever, Victor Belli. It doesn't mean that, but it doesn't mean that it will take away from your bass playing either, because it's very possible that some of you guys can play rings around Stanley Clark or play rings around Jaco or Jamal or Victor Wooten or whatever. It only means that this business of the music is a very superficial business, and sometimes it's not what you know, it's who you know. And I tried to let them understand that, because some guys, they could sit in their room and sit in their room and they forsake everything else. They forsake their families. They forsake eating. They forsake dating, getting married, having children, with the idea of them becoming this great music artist or whatever. And, you know, I always say that we plan, God plan, and God is the best of planners. And so you're moving in a certain direction, and all of a sudden stuff starts changing and shifting. And I tell them, some of you guys are going to be producers, and that's not going to take away from anything from your bass playing. Some of you are going to be great songwriters. That's not going to take away from anything from your bass playing. You might sit in a room with another writer and come up with a song, and the song becomes a smash hit. You'd be like, wow, I did that in 5 minutes. Let me do that again.
Right.
and I looked at that check, and that check was pretty fat. Let me see if I can do this again. And then, you know, you keep doing it. And then it's like, you know, what happened to you wanting to be Jamal and Takuba, who's starving? Like, oh, well, I'm writing these hit songs now. I can always put my finger on my customized $20,000 bass guitar that I bought with the money that I made from the hit record that I made last year that was on the commercial on whatever radio station or whatever TV show. So, you know, I try to get them to understand that some of you guys are going to be music promoters. Some of you guys are going to do your first show that weekend at the garage. You say, wow, I made $20 over the $100 that I've invested. Let's try this again. Before you know it, you're going to probably be booking the Rolling Stones at some venue somewhere that has nothing to do with your bass player. Maybe Mick Jagger might say, come on stage and play bass with us tonight. I mean, you know, I try to get the guys an understanding. So I try to tell them, look, don't worry yourselves. Just do the best work that you can do. Try to make your connections, yes, but don't backstab people on the way up. Don't hurt people on the way up. Don't hurt your family. Don't backbite people. All these things that people do trying to make it to the next level. Because, again, if it's for you, it's going to be for you. And if it's not for you, it's not going to be for you. So I tell the guys, look, this is a plan. Think about what it is that you want to do. If you want to be a session musician, you want to go out to California and Hollywood, you want to be a bass player that's going to work in these orchestras, okay, get your reading tight. You know, because those guys, when they're doing these movies, they don't have time to go, okay, for the bass player, can we try this 50 times so he can get it? No, wow. You got to be able to read that stuff, read that stuff right on sight. So if that's what you want to be trained for, get into that. If you want to be the kind of guy that you're in the studio and we're working on some stuff and there's no music charts, so your ear has got to be right. The piano player or somebody plays something and you have to hear it and duplicate that on your instrument, you have to train your ear. Mm-hmm. So I try to tell the guys, whatever way that you want to go, train yourself for that. And then they go, oh, okay, I understand now. Right. Can we jam now? Can we jam now? I say, yeah, now we can jam.
Agomo yuba elegwa cholona. Dima mogado. Dima. Dima yasowera. Dima. Dima makumkiria. Dima. Dima hamadabusu. Dima. Dima prince. Dima. Dima David Bowie, Dima. Dima de Suera, Dima. Dima Ganawi, Dima. Dima de Suera, Dima, the love, the feeling, the heart, the soul, the sea. Yeah. Now help me out here, people. Hold your hands up in the air. Yeah. Just feel that vibe of Esuera all around you. Spread that love. Spread that love. Spread that love. Spread that love. Yeah, spread that love. Dima. Dima. Say the word peace. come with the happiness.
You're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Sugar My Bowl's the name of this program. My name's Joyce Jones. And our guest for this evening is Jamaluddin Takuma. What you're listening to in the background is Esorira Groove. I think I'm pronouncing that correctly. From Jamaluddin Takuma's 2017 Nawa Soul Experience. And that's on Jam All Productions, Jamaluddin Takuma's label. Before that, we heard Takuma's song from Jamaluddin Takuma, Tony Kofi, Ornette Coleman, For the Love of Ornette. That is a 2012 Jazz Werkstatt release, German label. Ornette Coleman on alto saxophone, Jamaluddin Takuma on bass guitar, Justin Faulkner on acoustic drums, David Fingers Haynes on finger drums, Wolfgang Puschnigg on flute, Yoichi Azuki on piano, Tony Kofi on tenor saxophone, and Wadud Ahmad is the spoken word vocalist. Jamaluddin Takuma is also the producer on this release. And before that, we heard City Living from Ornette Coleman's 1985 Caravan of Dreams release. Caravan of Dreams. That's Ornette Coleman in prime time. Ornette Coleman on alto saxophone. He's also the composer. Jamaluddin Takuma is on bass. Before that, we heard Yes We Can from David Murray, Jamaluddin Takuma's Rendezvous Suite. That was a 2011 release on Jazzworks.org Records, featuring Amiri Baraka, Jamaluddin Takuma on bass guitar, Ranzel Merritt on drums, Mingus Murray, David Murray's son, on guitar, keyboards, Paul Urbanek, and David Murray on tenor saxophone and bass clarinet. And before that, we heard the title selection from Showstopper, Jamaluddin Takuma's debut as a leader. Jamaluddin Takuma on bass, Julius Hemphill on alto saxophone, Cornell Rochester on drums, Barbara Walker on vocals, and the producer, composer, arranger, and bassist on this selection is Jamaluddin Takuma. And before that, we heard from our departed queen, who will always be with us, Aretha Franklin, Hey Now Hey, The Other Side of the Sky. And we open the program with our theme from Nina Simone. I Want a Little Sugar in My Bowl. This is from the very best of Nina Simone. Sugar in My Bowl, 1967-1972. This was originally recorded in 1967. This is from a 1998 RCA BMG compilation. Stay tuned for our On the Bandstand segment with our associate producer Hank Williams. And more from Jamaluddin Takuma and Joyce Jones on Sugar in My Bowl on WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Sugar in My Bowl continues.
Good evening. Good evening, jazz fans. This is Hank Williams, and welcome to On the Bandstand for August 19th. This segment features aerial listings of Shiggin' My Bowl guests so you can see them live. And this week's guest is bassist Jamaluddin Takuma. He has no immediate upcoming area shows, but we'll let you know when he's back in the area. And we have a lot more listings for you this week. We start with saxophonist TK Blue, who's in Ossining, New York, at Henry Gordine Park on August 20th for a free outdoor concert, and that's sponsored by Jazz Forum Art. Harpist Brandy Younger leads a quartet at the Jazz Standard from August 21st to the 22nd. Pianist Harold Mayburn leads a trio at the Village Vanguard from the 21st through the 26th. And Connecticut fans can catch his trio at the Old Lime Inn on August 31st and September 1st. Guitarist Bill Frizzell has a residency at the Stone from the 21st through the 26th, and he's joined by drummer Andrew Surreal on the 23rd. He'll also be at National Sawdust in Brooklyn to perform a specially commissioned work on the 29th. Pianist Mark Carey's Harlem Sessions series continues with late Saturday night sets at Smoke on the 25th and September 1st. Master drummer Michael Carvin leads a trio at Kitano on the 25th. Harpist Riza Printup and bassist Mimi Jones team up to lead an ensemble at Newark's Bethany Baptist Church on the 26th. Bassist William Parker leads the In Order to Survive sextet at Jazz at Lincoln Center's Dizzy's Club from the 28th to the 29th, with saxophonist James Brandon Lewis and drummer Hamid Drake. Drummer Andrew Surreal is at the Village Vanguard with Joe Lovano from the 28th through September 1st. Saxophonist Gary Bartz is at Smoke for a Charlie Parker tribute from the 30th through September 1st. Drummer Lenny White is at the Jazz Standard with Cyrus Chestnut's trio from the 30th through September 2nd. He's also at Kitano on September 7th and 8th with George Coligan's trio. Saxophonist Billy Harper is at Birdland with the Cookers from September 4th through 8th. And bassist Christian McBride leads the New John Quartet at the Blue Note from September 4th through 9th. We finish this week with events at the annual Charlie Parker Jazz Festival, sponsored by the City Parks Foundation. Most of them are free. Trumpeter Adam O'Farrell and saxophonist Gary Bartz are both at the National Jazz Museum in Harlem on August 22nd for talks. Also on August 22nd is a screening of the documentary film Milford Graves' Full Mantis at Harlem's Hazel's Documentary Center, and there will be a discussion with Graves and the filmmaker. And you can see our review of the film on our blog. Saxophonist Gary Bartz and drummer Jack DeJeanette are at Harlem's Marcus Garvey Park on the 24th with Charles Tolliver. Vocalist Catherine Russell is at Garvey Park on the 25th, and saxophonist Gary Bartz and Amina Claudine Myers both headline sets at Tompkins Square Park on the 26th. That's all for this week. If you missed anything, full listings are on our blog. Go to sugarinmybowl.org and click the link for the blog, where you'll also find reviews, features, and jazz news. And Suga is spelled S-U-G-A. Playlists and audio from this and previous shows are also on the website. If you're on Twitter and Facebook, look for us there too, where we'd appreciate likes, tweets, and shares with your friends. And if you really like what we do, please help the station stay on the air by pledging whatever you can, and consider becoming a WBAI buddy with a monthly pledge. The support WBAI link on the Suga and My Bowl website has details, and we're grateful for any help you can give the station. This is Hank Williams signing off with our bi-weekly schedule. We're off the air next week. We'll have updated event listings online and be back on air on Sunday, September 2nd. Either way you connect, we'll see you next time on the Bandstand.
Yo, check this out. This is Chuck, your public enemy number one, the rebel without a pause, bringing the noise and fighting the power right here to the Sights and Sounds. That's right, Sights, 99.5 WBAI. Thank you.
So now I'm going to ask you, having taken the path that you've taken, how did you prepare yourself for writing and preparing charts and things of that nature?
Well, I do a lot of things right off of the bass. For some reason, just the way that I play, I like to do that. And it's very interesting the way that I play, transcribing what I play onto paper is very interesting because sometimes when I hear myself play, it's really weird. It's especially when I'm in improvised mode and I'm really with musicians and we're like sort of going at it and really improvising, not sort of like holding a certain kind of groove down when I'm really like spinning around and improvising.
Mm-hmm.
I listen to myself and I go, man, that sounds really interesting. I don't know anybody that sounds like that. And so what I do is I'm writing stuff. If it's really extremely hard, if I play something, I'm saying, I can't write this stuff down. Mm-hmm. I get somebody I know who can come in and that's what they do.
Okay, yes.
Here they can just blah, 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 blah. Okay, here it is. I hit them all. And I say, okay, cool. It's various ways that one can approach it and whatever works for you, then that's the way that you do it. If it's in your mind, you can always hum it to somebody.
Right, right.
Got that? Yeah, I got it. Next. It's not as hard as people try to. They try to make it. I mean, you guys like some great composers and, mm-hmm. you know, this and the other, but you got to understand also, some of these musicians, right, who are great leaders, when you take the music away from them, it's very difficult for them to, like, improv. They don't do that.
Right.
They can play off the charts, but then when it comes to, like, really getting into a groove, you'd be like, man, could you, like, unstiffen yourself a little
bit? Yes.
You know, could you get, like, a little bit more, you know, groovy with this thing?
Right.
Where's the music at? Where's the music?
Right.
I don't have any music. Can you just feel this? You know, so it's either one or the other, you know.
Right.
Then you have some guys that can do both.
Sure.
You know, and it's a blessing.
Right. I notice, actually, a lot of musicians that I've interviewed,
mm-hmm.
many of them have not been trained classically.
Yeah.
In some
right,
sort
right.
of system. And, of course, they can play everybody out of everything. They play
right.
so well, just
Evolve,
like yourself.
Yeah.
And something that they usually encounter, and I think you mentioned it earlier, when they're instructing younger artists who have been
mm-hmm.
trained classically, it's an effort, the younger musician. It's a
mm-hmm.
real effort to just relax.
Yeah, I know, and that's one of the things that I wanted to do here in Philadelphia. I wanted to open up a location that I can grab these kids when they're younger and really work with them. It's funny, I spoke to Donardo Coleman last month on that Sun.
Yes.
And I was like, Donardo, you know, we should start a harmonic summer camp. He was like, wow, Jamal,
yeah.
that's a great idea. That way we can grab some of these young and work with them and give them another form of expression, you know, inspire them in a different way so they won't be so uptight on their instrument.
Right.
You know? Not to say that the classical guys are uptight or anything like that, but just trying to get them where they can really open up and free themselves and not be sort of chained down to a certain thought or pattern.
Right. I mean, I think of somebody classically trained, like Yo-Yo Ma, and he still looks the same when he's playing. When I would see him
right.
perform, he was so relaxed. He almost looked like he was rocking out. He was so comfortable
right.
in what he was doing.
Yeah. You have to build up a certain amount of technical
sure.
prowess. You can do that, you know, but then after that, what are you going to do with it?
As you mentioned before about the possibility or, you know, getting stuck in just playing the thing that you got paid lots of money doing.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. I was talking to Ray Parker Jr., the guitarist,
mm-hmm. yes.
producer.
Yes.
And, you know, Ray, he explained to us, Steve Jordan, the drummer out
yes.
of New York, put this band together called the Super Soul Band,
mm-hmm.
Banned. And that band is comprised of myself on bass, Steve Jordan on drums, Ray Parker Jr. on guitar, another guitar younger brother named Sharky Isaiah plays with D'Angelo on guitar, Ronald Bell from Kool & the Gang. And so we get together and we play these concerts, which is killing because these are just great musicians.
Uh-huh.
Thank you.
But I was talking to Dre, and we're sitting down between the rehearsals. He's just like, play a song. I say, that's a nice song. He says, you know, I played on it. I was like, what? Did you play on that song too? And he just keeps like, you know, playing a song that he's played on. Like a Barry White from Love and Limited Orchestra or Marvin Gaye.
Yes.
I want you album.
Yes.
He played on that whole album.
Oh my goodness.
Played on that. I'm like, that's my favorite album. What? And then he'll say, well, you know, when I was like 17, I wrote that song for Chaka Khan called You Got the Love. What? You
wow.
Got the Love? What? You know,
right.
I said, Ray, oh my gosh. So I said, Ray, I have to know this because the music business has changed now. My path has taken me a different way, but I just have to know this. I got to ask you something. He says, what? I said, do you think from the way that I play, if I was living in L.A. or New York at the time, in the 70s when a lot of stuff was happening, do you think I could have did very well? He said, man, you could have made a ton of money. I was like, really? He says, man, it was so much work. It was so many sessions.
Great.
He said, we would have been cutting this group and then like 10 other groups in line waiting for you to cut with them. And then you would have been getting most of your gigs from other bass players.
Right.
Because there was so much work to go around. So, you know, it's really interesting how that one kid gets also stuck in that kind of world. I was talking to my wife. She was like, well, maybe if you would have done that, maybe you might not have been as fluent a musician as you are. Because
exactly.
You, who knows, having 1,000 people around you telling you what to play, how to play it, change that around. You got a lawyer just coming in the room. Only because he's the one that got the record deal. He's going to sit in the engineering room now. He's going to start, well, maybe you can change that. Man, get out of here. You know, I mean, and that's the kind of stuff that happens.
Right,
you know,
exactly.
He's the one that got the deal. So now he's entitled to come into the producer's room, sit in the producer's chair and start saying what he thinks. And he don't know nothing from nothing or whatever.
Right.
You know, and it's that kind of stuff. So I'm really happy that I chose the path that I've taken, and I'm really satisfied with that.
You know, I like to talk about people who were there during that time. In New York, there's like this period between, I guess, 1975 and 95, I guess.
Yeah.
There's this period when the music, anyone could play anything, especially in the improvisation area. People, they would be playing jazz, but they're also playing rock, but they're also playing Brazilian music, but they're also playing all in that,
right,
you know.
Right. Yeah, like you were saying, like from that period up until the 90s, this whole world music scene was beginning to happen, and these different fusions of world music was happening. And so, like Ornette, early on, he started playing with the Djajouka musicians from Morocco. Matter of fact, I'm not sure if you're familiar with that movie, Naked Lunch.
Yes, exactly.
He did the music for that. And then so he was using some of those Djajouka musicians in that. But he had done that already years before that when we were in Paris in 1976 or whatever. He had worked with them. And then on my record, I had did a record called Music World. And I went all around the world just to play with different people and stuff. And so you had in the 80s to the 90s, you had that kind of acceptance happening in the music and even on people's records. You know, you would, one track would be one way, another track would be another. And it was just being accepted. To this point right now, it's like when you listen to radio, you hear a lot of stuff. You hear just all kinds of stuff. And I think the younger folks are, their ears have been sort of in tune to that, sort of been prepared for that at that period that you mentioned.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was also wondering, I suspect you were here in New York when the Knitting Factory was the place to go.
Yeah. It, you know, it's funny, though. I've always lived in Philadelphia. Some people think I live in Europe. Some people think I live out there. No, but I'm still right here in Philly, right?
Right.
But it's interesting, though, about the whole New York scene, because that whole downtown scene was John Zorn and Bill Laswell and Arto Lindsey and Anton Fear. And all those guys, you know, John Laurie, they kind of like took me in. And they took me in because they dug the stuff that I was doing with Ornette. So it was like that whole downtown scene, the Knitting Factory, you know, we were frequenting there. It was like a whole thing that was happening with that. I was kind of taken into that world also because a friend of ours named Kip Hammerhand, he was a producer. And he started doing like all these records with like collaborations with like all these different people, putting different people together. And so that was the kind of stuff that was happening. That was the kind of music that was happening in New York at that time as well. So I was happy to be a part of that. We had a band called the Golden Palominos.
Yes.
And that was like a pretty interesting group, you know. You know, some bunch of crazy guys in that band, you know, playing some crazy, interesting music, you know, and it was cool.
my mouth. Clean pay, clean pay, that clean pay. Clean pay, clean pay. Excuse me, in my brain starts falling, my tongue's so blunt, and last night's got hurt. Who's in a hurry? My life was fuzzy. Taxi, question, is that the same right? You flash my eyes. Hey, yo, back my show. What the boom, the bass, I be not to be dead, die. Thickly, the sun gets thinking. It's either strictly defined, defined. But, see, please make I die of a cop.
Tell me about how that came together and who was involved and all that.
Well, it was the drummer Anton Fear and Bill Laswell and Otto Lindsay. They basically started it, and Zorn, you know, those are the guys that were making records with each other at the time anyway. It was a label that was out of France called Celluloid. They were doing some stuff. Gramavision was doing some stuff. The band came together because of all the guys that were doing different things, and we just decided to come together and do that. And they pulled me in.
Oh, okay. So your releases as a leader after all that time with Ornette and doing doing other things with other people? How was it doing your own?
It was really exciting doing my first record. Showstopper was done, and Ornette wrote a song on that for me. I also wrote a piece called The Bird of Paradise, which was for string quartet and harp. And I had a dream that I wanted a classical singer to sing on it. And I couldn't think of who, but I wanted somebody in the spirit of Marian Anderson, that kind of thing. And I said, wow, I would love to be able to get somebody. So I remember that movie Diva. I was like, man, Wilhelmina Fernandez, that's a great vocalist. But I said, oh my gosh, she probably lives in Europe somewhere. I'd probably never be a good. Found out she lived in Philly.
Wow.
And Opera Philadelphia was during her management. So they connected me with her. We did the record in New York, and that was nice. You know, we're talking about the variation of tracks. And that was a problem also for the label a little bit because the stores didn't really know where to place me. It wasn't like strictly jazz. It wasn't strictly rock. It wasn't strictly funk. It was like all these things on one record. And Gramavision allowed me to do that because they had the vision to see where the music was going as well. They just let me do what I wanted to do. And all my records, I just always did what I wanted to do. Even to the point where I was, one record I did called Groove 2000. I invited Grover Washington Jr. to play on the track along with The Roots. And The Roots were a Philly band.
Right.
That I kind of introduced them to the New York scene. You know, I had taken them to Europe for the first time
They
went to Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And so that record, Groove 2000, that was released in the year 2000. And that was a lot of different stuff that was on there, you know, that record as well. So I've always been eclectic in my taste in music and in my productions. That's just the way that I do what I do. And me having my label now, it allows me really to do what I want to do. I have this one record that I just released called Sparkfire with Odine Polk and Henry Grimes.
Wow.
Two young drummers from Philadelphia named Justin Faulkner, who plays with Branford Marcellus. And I started playing with Justin when he was only 13. Yeah. And he has a brother named Nazir Ebo, plays drums also, so they're both on the album. A trumpeter named Haroon Shabaka Ra.
Yes.
Plays with
the
Sun
Ra Orchestra.
The orchestra. Mm-hmm. Yeah. He's on the record. Tim Motzer, he's a guitar player, so he's on the record. So Sparkfire is a record that's coming out.
When is it coming out?
I'm speaking to some labels now. It's on my label, but I'm speaking to some other labels about distribution. I do this festival every year called the Outsiders Improvised and Creative Music Festival.
I was going to ask you about that. I love the concept. How long has that been going on?
This has been going on for about 4 years now. Yeah.
And the thing that I noticed about it was you have, like, all these great improvisers. And it's sort of the way the name, I noticed in this past year, the way it was laid out on the poster, it's like the outsiders. It's like that's essentially what you all are, the outsiders creating improvised and creative music.
Right. Yeah, because, you know, in a sense, and also introducing people to the music that wouldn't normally be heard.
Yes.
Not unless it was a standard jazz venue or something like that. So I just took it upon myself to do that, and I'm glad I did. The word is getting around, and I've had some, like, heavy hitters on there. I mean, people that's come through, like John Zorn came through.
Yes.
Henry Grimes has played.
Yes.
Odine Pope has played there.
Harriet Tubman.
Yes. Yeah, Elliot Levin. New saxophonist named James Brandon Lewis.
Yes.
Cahill El-Zabar. David Berry.
Yes.
You know, so I'm like, what? What have I done here? But, you know, they all come because they know me. Like, Jamal, look, you're doing it, we coming through. And that's the beautiful thing about it. I've never made any enemies in this business over these years. The guys love me, and I love the guys. So somebody say, Jamal, you have a legion. And when you think about it, it is kind of a legion. You know, these guys are really, you know.
It's like Marvel Legion.
Yeah, exactly. The Outsiders.
Exactly.
Oh, my gosh.
Now, the thing about The Outsiders, how did you wind up putting that together? I mean, I know you decided you would do it.
Well, what happened was, I've got to tell it. I mean, I've told
it
before, I'm going to tell it here.
Yes.
What happened was, you know, they had this Jazz Appreciation Month in April.
Yes.
And so I'm walking around Philadelphia, and I see this big, huge poster of me. And I'm like, wow, what is that? That's a cool poster of me, but what is that for? And I read that, you know, April is Philadelphia Jazz Appreciation Month, and they have listed, like, all of these concerts that are happening, right? And I say, well, I'm not on any of those concerts.
Wow.
I'm like, nobody asked me to do anything.
And maybe yet they're using your face to promote.
Yeah, but they're using my face to promote. I'm like, that's interesting. I say, well, here we go again. You know, it's not what you know, it's who you know, blah, 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 blah. And I said, you know what? I'm going to put together my own festival. The first one I called the Outsiders Pop-Up, and that was with Marshall Allen and Danny Ray Thomas, DJ King Britt, guitarist from New York named Ava Mendoza, who I just got finished doing a recording with. And it was a fantastic evening, and it just worked. And I found some sponsorship, and I was able to put it together. It's just been going ever since. So that's how it came about.
So for those who didn't catch that, it happens in April. It's usually like around the end of the month near the International Jazz Day that happens.
Exactly.
Like the 30th,
exactly.
April 30th.
Mm-hmm.
But does it fall on a Saturday or Sunday?
Yeah, it's always like probably a Friday, Saturday, or Sunday. This year, we kind of broke off and had it at the main place that we have it at, which was the Philadelphia International House on the campus of the University of Pennsylvania. We had it there. Then we also broke off and did it in two other venues. One venue called the Milk Boy. I had Vernon Reed and Calvin Weston. We have a band called Freeform Funky Creek.
Yes.
We had that there. And then at this place called South here in Philadelphia, I had a guitarist named Nels Klein.
Yes.
And Chad Taylor on drums.
Oh, my goodness.
A young brother on saxophone named Alfredo Colon.
Okay.
He has a band called Secret Mall, and they came and played at the festival. I mean, it's blowing my mind now just talking about it, you know.
Uh-huh.
And then we also record each particular concert, and I make that recording available to folks the next year. So they can purchase it or whatever, you know.
Okay.
So,
and it's on your label, I suspect.
It's on my label, yes.
Excellent.
On production.
Excellent.
Mm-hmm. I'm also working on this opera in Italy with a composer there. So we're going to work on it together. And also, I produced a record with a group called The Last Poets.
Yes.
Yeah, Abby O'Dune and Babatunde.
Babadon, right.
Uh-huh. Right. That record is going to come out soon. Talking to a label about distributing that. And this Ornette Coleman opera that I'm working on in Italy. Yeah, stuff is just constantly going on. I'm just trying to keep up with it all myself.
You were with Abby O'Dune. This was actually your band, Brother Zone, that you performed at the Winter Jazz Festival.
At the Winter Jazz, yeah. That was good. That was nice.
But you have a recording of the Brother Zone with Oren Evans,
yes.
I think?
No, not Oren, but there's a record with Oren Evans I did, The Flavors of Thelonious Monk.
Oh, okay.
And then I think Oren's on Coltrane Configuration.
Okay.
This music that I did in tribute to John Coltrane.
Okay.
Yeah, Oren's on that.
But tell me about Brother Zone.
Brother Zone is a group that is comprised of John Paul Borelli on guitar, a drummer from Philly boy named Dal Burgi and a poet named Wadud Ahmed from Philadelphia, who had his own records out as well. And we touch on some social issues. We touch on what's going on. And we try to hit really hard, you know, in terms of the music. We just try to, like, just make people aware of what's going on.
Which I believe is why you were included in this past Winter Jazz Festival, since that was their focus.
Yep. Well, this record with the last poet, there's some pretty heavy stuff on there also. You know, I want to get this record out. I think you're talking fall.
Okay. Tell me about the, what is it, Red Room?
Oh, the Red Carpet Room.
Yes! Tell me about that!
That's what I'm sitting at right now. The Red Carpet Room came about from my passion of vintage clothing and just fashion and style in general. Because again, going back to the Uptown Theater, you know, I saw everybody there. I saw James Brown there with his famous, I'm talking before '70s, before Bootsy was in the band, he had James Brown and a famous flame.
Right.
And it was like him and then like three guys that would dance, and they would just be so clean. You know, it was just crazy. Smokey Robinson, he's just come on stage so clean. The five stair steps, they would just, they would just come on stage and just kill it. The man had the Unifics and Donny Hathaway. And all these people would come on stage and they would just be so sharp. And so all of that stuck in my mind. So even from my first album, I said, it's got to be this way. It's got to be this way. It's got to be this way. And so I've always had the passion of vintage stuff. Friends of mine who were always trading in high school. Well, I traded that flannel shirt for those Humphrey Bogart pants. That skinny belt for those two-tone shoes. You know, we would trade back and forth. And thrifting was our thing. And then when I found out that you can get, like, an item for, like, so cheap, it was like, wow, this is great. And something that's really cool designed and perhaps a designer name that you know. And this is so cool. So I've always been involved in style and fashion in that way. When I was traveling to Europe, I mean, I was always, like, trading guys. And then guys were buying things off of me. They were buying, like, wow, Jamal, that's a cool hat. Can I get it? I was like, oh man. All right, give me some money for it. You can get it, right? So I was, you know, it was like getting stuff to them like that. To got to the point when I was going to Europe, I don't even take a bass guitar anymore for two reasons. For one of my bass guitars was lost. The airline lost it, and I said to myself, I am never taking any of my bass guitars again. Mm. So what I do is I tell the promoter, just like you provide the drums for the drummer, because he ain't taking all those drums on anyone. Not the regular guys. Maybe Earth, Wind & Fire, they're taking their stuff in their vault cabinets and their, you know, their hard cases, and, you know, which is under the plane. I'm not carrying any of that stuff. So I want you to tell the promoter to provide a Fender Jazz Bass or Fender Precision Bass. Both of those are standard basses. It's all about my fingers. It's not about, you know, I've never been like a gear snob where I've got to have this special thing. And it's got to be, no. Just pick that thing up and just start playing it. Just start rocking it. You know, So I just tell them, have either one of those two basses and I'm cool. Mm. Any small adjustments I have to make, I'll do that right there. So what I'll do is I take my empty suitcase and I'm hitting flea markets and I'm hitting consignment shops over there. And I'm buying stuff and I'm buying stuff and I'm bringing it back. And a lot of times before I even get home, I'm taking photos and I'm sending it to my guys. And my guys is like, Jamal, I want that. I want that. I want that. You make sure nobody gets it. So before I even get home, all the stuff that I didn't grab is already sold and gone. The first day that I get home, chances up at the Red Carpet Room, lined up. That's mine. That's mine.
Nice.
You know, what I've been able to do also, they trust my eye.
Mm-hmm.
They know that I'm serious about this, so they trust me. Because the other side of it is that most musicians, they're into their craft. Mm-hmm. They don't really have the time to really go deep and do what I do.
Right.
I'm going to a flea market. I'm going to a thrift store every day.
Mm.
I'm going to an estate sale every day. I got my overalls on, and somebody say, that person is moving. You can come in their house and get everything they got. I'm in there. I'm going to, 1960s Battalion Nick.
Wow.
1950s Schiaparelli. You know, 1970s Pierre Cardin.
Wow.
So I'm going crazy. So I'm grabbing stuff. And so that's what I do. So the Red Carpet Room was in a building that I had, and I was renting the space upstairs. When the people moved out, you know, I was like, wow, I don't know if I want to get anybody else up here, because I know those folks, and, you know, I don't know who else I bring up here, and I don't know how they are, this and the other. So I said, let me just start this spot up here where all the stuff that I was selling in these other locations, I can just bring it all here, and guys can come up here and get their things. What I'm able to do is provide stuff to them that they would not normally see. Also, my main thing is that I'm buying stuff as cheap as I can so I can sell to them as cheap as they can. So they're up here, and they're looking at some lizard shoes, some gator shoes that would normally go for like $600, and they can buy those shoes for me for $75. They're like, oh, give me three of those right now. So I can find stuff really cheap, and then I can sell to them cheap.
There are two things I want to ask you about before we get going. I really appreciate the time you've given.
You're so welcome.
G. Calvin Weston. You have spent so much time with him. You were with him when you were with Ornette, and you're still recording with him now.
And I recorded his first album.
Yes. Tell me about your working together all these years.
You know, we have a pretty interesting relationship in terms of the music, whereas we've understood from an improvisational standpoint how to interact and how to weave from an organic standpoint in the groove factor. We've demonstrated that with Ornette. We've demonstrated that with the guitarist Derek Bailey, with James Blood Omer, through various bands, through Freeform Funky Freaks, with Mark Rebo.
Yes.
So we have that kind of relationship, you know, so it's pretty cool.
In mentioning Mark Rebo, the Young Philadelphians, mm-hmm. I really, really, and I suspect you really, really enjoy it too, because it's Young Philadelphians.
Right, the Young Philadelphians, and we're touching on those songs that I grew up with, and they're being rearranged and broken down and deconstructed, and that's a beautiful thing to be able to do that, you know, to material that you grew up with. And those songs that Kenny Gamble and Leon Huff wrote are timeless.
And you revisit the bass lines.
I revisit the bass lines. You know, and Ronnie Baker. Yeah, they expand them. And Ronnie Baker, who was the original bass player who played on all that stuff, he doesn't get credit like he should.
Mm.
His name was Ronnie Baker, Philadelphia International Records, the Philly Sound bass player. Yep.
Wow. And James Brandon Lewis, you were on his Days of Freeman release.
Days of Freeman release, yep. And like I said, he joined me on the Outsiders Festival one year.
Right.
And he is absolutely a wonderful saxophonist, serious about his work,
mm-hmm.
and just a beautiful person to be around in terms of his spirit. And for me, that's the most important thing.
Yes.
Because, you know, you might have some famous people, whatever, but if I get a sense that they're not cool or they're really showing me a side of them that is humanly not digestible, I don't include them in my circle. So, and I don't care how famous they are. You know, if they show me that they're not cool, they're not going to hang with me. Like James is really cool to hang with. It's just a blessing being around him. And I can see him just moving so forward in terms of what he wants to do. Because, you know, like I said, he's serious about what he does. And he sounds good.
Yeah, I noticed a lot of the recordings that you've been on, several of them have been with people who have been either guests on this show or we want to have them as guests on this show because they're
right.
So cool.
Yeah, I mean, that's how it's supposed to be.
Yeah. You mentioned earlier Ava Mendoza, that you did something with her.
Just with her just recently, yeah.
Right. And in our discussing the list of musicians, we're talking about male artists. Are there women
right.
artists that are in this circle as well?
Yeah. You know, not many, though. Well, there's a singer here in Philadelphia named Barbara Walker,
uh-huh.
and she sung on my first album, Showstopper.
Right.
There were people along the way, the Ebony String Quartet
mm-hmm.
that played on Renaissance Man and played on Showstopper,
right.
String Quartet here in Philly, Wilhelmina Fernandez. But it's not like a lot of ladies that are circling right now that are involved. Ava's one. And I guess Mary Halverson is a guitarist.
Yes, she's with
you know,
the
we've
Young
done some things. Yeah, actually,
yes.
Mary and I, here we go. Mary and I have a record that I'm going to release soon called Strings and Things.
Oh.
It's a duet. As you mentioned, and I'm like thinking, oh yeah, her. And I was like, no, I don't have these ladies. Oh yeah, her.
And there's Mary.
And
also,
there's Mary.
Who has also been a sugar guest.
Okay, yep.
How is it for you working with Mary? I know you already do Young Philadelphians together, and now deciding to do this duet. How did that come
about? Yeah, the duet. The thing about it, as a producer, I can kind of hone in onto what someone does and see how I can fit with that, see how we can fit with each other. So when we would be playing, I noticed that she had a certain way of execution on her guitar, and I noticed that she had a certain sound palette. So I was like, well, we could do that. And we did that in our studio. So it worked out really fine. So Strings and Things. So that's going to be that.
Okay. I also noticed that, you know, I'm hesitant to even mention this because I'm not really a fan of her vocals, but Linda Sharrock.
Right. Oh, Linda Sharrock, yeah.
Maybe it's better not to find me in love. Maybe it's better not to find real happiness. Sometimes when I watch the setting sun, I wonder, suppose there are some gods above. They're the ones who brought your love. Sometimes
it's better not to find real love. Maybe it's hard not to find real happiness. Sometimes as I watch the setting sun, I wonder. Suppose there are some gods above, and they're the ones who brought your love. I'm loving you.
Really interesting, though. She's the outsider.
Uh-huh.
I mean, in the true sense of the word,
yes.
Of utilizing her vocals to really try to challenge what can be done.
Yes.
You know, because the vocals is an instrument that we're so used to hearing, and it can be so sweet, and like a guitar is up in the front, the band is behind them. It can be so sweet, but sometimes to come out of that kind of comfortable zone could be interesting sometimes. And that, to me, that's what Linda does. And she's been having some hard times lately because she had a few strokes. She's living in Austria right now, and she's been ill.
Mm-hmm.
But I personally treasure her particular style because, you know, yeah, I can get everybody else to sing the way that they do, but nobody's really coming forth like that.
Right.
You know, for me, that's just the difference of it. Yeah. But
well,
I understand your feeling because it is quite different. Yeah.
Well, my thing also is I tend to be somebody who's into low tones or low end. Kind of.
Okay.
Vocals. And you don't hear enough of that for me. Sopranos are here, there, and everywhere.
Yeah, that's what you're saying, yeah.
So someone like Gene Lee.
Oh, Gene Lee. Yeah, I mean, his name sounds familiar. Yeah. Andy Bay has an interesting voice, too.
I love him. We share the same birthday, actually.
Good. That's nice.
Just hearing him and a piano just is
it's enough.
A treat.
It's enough.
Yeah.
Actually, by himself, it would be cool.
Yes.
You know?
Nothing. A cappella.
Yeah, a cappella is cool. His voice just by itself is so rich.
Indeed. So, Archie Shepp, how did you wind up? Had you been playing with him over the years?
Not a lot. I just played with him one time with the guitar player I was mentioned before named Jean-Paul Borelli. Jean-Paul is from Chicago originally, but he was living in Berlin for the longest. He had a birthday concert in Berlin, and Archie came because he had played with Archie before. That was like I played with Ornette. Jean-Paul cut his teeth with Archie.
Oh, okay.
So he had a birthday party, and Archie came and played, and we played together there. So that was the last time. That was maybe about 4 years ago. And that was the last time that I saw Archie, so it's nice to play with him again.
There was one other something. I read somewhere that you have a bass quartet, and it literally is three basses and a drummer.
Four basses and a drummer.
Oh.
Yeah, it's called Basso Nouveau.
Yes.
Listening to WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Sugar and My Bowl is the name of this program. My name's Joyce Jones. What you're listening to in the background is All Praises Due. That's from Jamaluddin and Basso Nouveau from The Night of Chamber Music, Moore's Music, 1993. Jamaluddin Takuma on 4-string electric bass, Gerald Veasley on 6-string electric bass, Jerome Hunter on upright double bass, and Juan Pablo Nahar also on double upright bass. And Edgar Bateman on drums. Before that, we heard an excerpt from Linda. It's Linda Chirac from Linda Chirac and the Three Man Band. This is a 1991 Moore's Music release. Linda Chirac on vocals, and she also wrote the lyrics. Jamala Dean Takuma on bass. Wolfgang Pushdick on alto saxophone, program sound, keyboards, voice, piccolo flute, and a WX7 synthesizer. Frank Samba on drums, and also electric drums. Before that, we heard another selection from Showstopper, Bird of Paradise, a 1983 Grammavision Records release. Before that, we heard Clean Plate from the Golden Palominos. This is a Golden Palominos 1983 Celluloid Records release. Before that, we heard snippet from YouTube of the Super Soul Band Jammin'. And before that, we heard Zam Zam, Such a Wonderful Feeling, from Jamila Dean Takuma's 1987 Grammavision release, Jukebox. And before that, we heard our On the Bandstand segment with our associate producer, Hank Williams.
Myself on 4-string, Gerald Veasley on 6-string, Tyrone Brown on upright electric, and Warren Ory on upright acoustic. In the drummer, we just pick up anybody anywhere. We had two drummers, Edgar Bateman, who passed away a couple years ago, and then we had a drummer from Philadelphia named Webb Thomas. But yeah, this quartet is something that is really interesting as well. Another Takuma crazy thing.
Well, I also understand that there's a technical thing that could happen, not for the good, but you, as a quartet, managed to make it work. There's something technically that could really go wrong, but you make it work.
Guys in the same register. Yeah, it's the whole thing. I had to go over with these guys, you know, as to how we can approach this. Somebody has to always be in a different register. Somebody has to play a melody. Somebody has to think of chords. Somebody has to think of rhythm. It's a whole thing. We just think like a band.
So you just woke up and say, I want to play with some other bassists.
Yeah, Gerald, he always teases me because as a producer, I can do so many things. I'm always thinking of interesting things to do. Mm-hmm. And especially now that I'm like an elder statesman, you might say, I'm like putting things together. But I've always done that. But now I'm in a position where I can talk to a label and say, look, I don't want to just do one Jamala Dean Takuma album. I like to do a production deal where I can bring you some fresh blood. Let's get some fresh stuff happening. So I'm the elder statesman. So they look at me and go, oh, we can respect Jamala Dean. Let him bring us some cool stuff.
Oh, cool.
You know, so, but Gerald, he laughed at me because about 10 years ago when I started Bossa Nova, we were at an airport, and he just reminded me the other day when he was giving me this award. We was all sitting around the table. He said, Jamal, I remember when you was at the airport and you were talking about doing Bossa Nova. You talked about it, and then all of a sudden, next week, you had the studio booked. You had money, songs ready.
So, yes. Yeah.
And speaking of that award, pardon my exclusion, you received a Benny Golson Award?
I received the Benny Golson Award that was given to me by the mayor of Philadelphia here,
yes.
City Hall of Philadelphia. And I recently received, what's it called? I'm looking at it now. It's called the Pennsylvania State Senator Vincent Hughes and his wife, Shirley Ralph Hughes, you know, the actress.
Uh-huh.
They gave me the Jazz Legacy Award.
That's it. Yay! Somebody had posted some video on Facebook. Yay!
Uh-oh. I'll be up there crying.
No, no.
That was funny. I'm sitting there, and the mayor's talking. See, that award, the Philadelphia City Hall Award, was kind of major because, you know, my hometown, Philadelphia City Hall, the mayor,
mm-hmm.
It was so surreal. And weeks before that, I say, I know I'm going to cry. I know I'm going to get up there. I know it. Oh, don't do it. So I was kind of cool, and I was sitting down, and all of a sudden, the mayor, he starts talking. You know, he starts letting people know, Jamali Takuma, he started doing this, blah, blah, blah. Then he was showing a video. I was looking at the video, and I'm like, oh, my gosh. As soon as I got up there, I started tearing up, right? Not only was I tearing up, but the photo that was caught was me having, like, both of my hands on my eyes. Like,
oh,
I looked like a little boy. The newspaper the next day says, why is this famous jazz musician crying at City Hall?
Right.
It was funny. It was so funny. I was like, oh my gosh. I just couldn't contain it. I started thinking about my mother who had passed away. I started thinking about all the stuff that I had experienced in Philadelphia getting to that particular point. And it was just nice. It was tears of joy.
That's wonderful.
The mayor was looking at me like, it's okay. He was like, you're a good man. You're
oh
good
my
man.
Goodness. Yeah, I think you know that. Well, thank you so much, Jamila Dean Takuma, for
you're
hanging
so welcome.
With us.
You're so welcome. You're so welcome.
Peace.
Okay. Peace. Bye-bye.
And we're closing out the program with Relax. That's Jamila Dean Takuma and The Roots. And Jamila Dean Takuma mentioned earlier that they accompanied him to New York for the first time. This is from Groove 2000, a 1998 Caramel Records release. Jamila Dean Takuma on bass, Grover Washington Jr. on tenor saxophone, Black Thought is the spoken word vocalist, Questlove on drums, and Richard Waller III on keyboards. Stay tuned for La Nueva Alternativa, coming up next, right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Sugar in My Bowl is scheduled to return on September 2nd. Stay tuned.
Hello. Bueno, this is Sonia Sanchez. I urge you to give your generous support to listener-sponsored community radio, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York.